Over the Garden Gate, a program brought to you by the University of California Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program of Tuolumne County. The mission of the UCCE Master Gardeners is to provide research-based gardening information to the public. If you would like to contact our Master Gardener Program, please call our hotline, which is area code 209-533-5912. The hotline is not manned full-time, but we do pick up our messages and we will get back to you within the week.
Where are we running right now?
Yep.
Oh, okay. So today I'm going to talk about erosion control for small property owners. And when I say small property owners, this is, say, the person that has an acre or more, but say less than 100 acres. It's a little bit more manageable in that sense. And I'm not really going to talk about residential much unless you want to talk about residential. And the reason why I say that is, as far as erosion control around a third acre lot or a small lot, there's a lot less involved, and it really comes down to some very simple methods and simple monitoring that needs to be done. First off, my name is Patrick Congdon. I'm a master gardener here in Tuolumne County. And my erosion control experience goes back to the 1970s and on small and large scales. Large scale meaning hundreds of acres, if not thousands of acres in some projects. So I do have a little bit of, I've touched on a little bit of things. I've touched on a number of things that are in the erosion control world, I'd sort of speak. So let me start off by saying a little bit about a residential. I gave a presentation to the Master Gardeners. Prior to that, I went around in Tuolumne and Mariposa County. I just said, I'm gonna go down this street, or I'm gonna go downtown Mariposa and look at how they were dealing with, and this was mostly storm runoff. And what I found was the real simple things that can lead to problems around the home, which is that having proper gutters, downspouts, water control once it actually gets to the base of the home. There were just many examples of where people just didn't do basic things to protect their homes. So, I mean, it was obvious in some areas water was getting into the home. You could see foundations cracking and settling. And if a little bit of maintenance, a little bit of monitoring would have been done, they could have avoided all these things. And so in some cases, you could be talking thousands of dollars worth of damage. I mean, there were two businesses in this area where a landscaper, I'm assuming, disconnected the drain pipe from the bottom of the downspout. So what ended up happening was all that water went down into the corner of the structure, and you could see that it had been happening for a while. And you could see some minor cracking in the foundation of that structure already. So, you know, that's just one simple thing, but it is simple from the fact that, you know, it doesn't take a lot, it's not expensive, but you do have to go out and monitor it. You know, in this case, nobody paid attention to it. It's like, well, it's up, it's fine. I'll use an example right over here, and I showed some photos of that, and I want to say it's the Social Security building. And significant damage to the slope, probably had a minor debris flow that could have been avoided. They essentially had a gutter and downspout coming to a unprotected area, and that area became saturated and a portion of the hillside slid. They've since gone up and put in an extension from the end of the downspout to take it down into a controlled area. But the damage has been done. The other thing when you go up there is that in a lot of these developments, they'll put in some type of contour trench to gather surface runoff, collect it, put it into a channel so it can be, you know, carried off or moved off to a site where it can be managed and you don't have the erosion issues. Once again, in that same area, there's this nice concrete ditch that no one has maintained. It's not only full of leaves and soil, but there's brush growing into it, and the brush that has come through the cracks in this contour trench have made it just, it's very ineffective. And in fact, it's probably not working at all. And I actually, when I was working in Pacifica years ago, back in the early 80s, there were several homes that slid down hills that were in development, and those contour trenches were never maintained. So rather than channeling surface to a point, and then if those, not failed, but if they were maxed out, there was another series of trenches down below, or contour trenches down below. None of those were maintained, and so the water came down, saturated a slope, and the homes, you know, basically slid down the slope. So it's those kinds of things. The nice things they've done up here, most of the newer homes, is they've taken the end of their downspouts. Now, you can put a dissipator on the end of your downspout so that when the water comes down from the gutter and it is released into an area outside the home, that it can disperse. They do say, and it is, for the most part, depending on your soils and what you have around there, you want to have at least 5 feet of dispersion, you know, from your home out. So, you know, these people get, if you go to Orchard Supply in some of these areas, you can see those downspout dissipators. They're like a funnel, and they're about that long. That's not sufficient. They really need to be much longer. What they've done up here is they've run, almost in all cases, 3-inch pipe, flexible corrugated pipe that runs from the home out to the street. The only problem is, the best way to do it is to run it from the home, your front yard, under your sidewalk, and put it in the gutter at the edge of the street. All of these here come to the sidewalk, and then they have some type of bubbler system that comes up. So basically the water flows through the pipe, and then it kind of bubbles out of the end piece. Well, there's lots of examples up here where driveway corners are being saturated and they're breaking off because that soil saturated, it can't take the weight of a vehicle. It's getting underneath the sidewalk, and it's also backing up towards the home. So there are some good examples up the road, but there's also some not so good examples. So I'm going to move away from the residential side a little bit and get more onto properties. The biggest thing I see from an erosion control standpoint on properties is improperly constructed and maintained roads or driveways even. Because, well, I'll use you folks as an example because you're here and you wanted to listen to this talk. What is your situation at home?
We've got an acre and a half up in Plainhorse.
Okay.
We had to take out at least 30 mature trees. So
okay. Right.
But we're still having a little bit of a problem with erosion. So I'm trying to figure out the best way to control that, because otherwise it's going to come down next to the house between the propane tank and the house. We really don't want erosion.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to move away from roads then, because I want to focus, because that's why you're here. And so I want to spend my time on that. But let me point out a few things. I highly recommend, UC does as well, if you go through the University of California documents. There's also one, there's a website called the Landowner's Guide to Building Forest Access Roads. There's also just a University of California publication called Forest Roads and Managing Small Forest Roads and Small Property Roads. Where we all start off with is planning, and I'll move to that. So for people that know their backyards or their lot is going to be significantly impacted by equipment coming in, pedestrian travel, you know, log skidding, you know, all of those things, I would recommend that before they do anything, they sit down and talk and develop a plan. Because what may happen is, and I've seen this, is that, okay, we need to have this work done on this slope. Well, you find out that the best way to get in there is to come through your neighbor's yard. Well, if you don't have a good relationship with your neighbor, if you don't have an easement right away, then they're going to have to come through some other way.
Actually, all the neighbors have to come through.
Okay. Yeah. And that can be a real problem. I don't know if you experienced some issues, but I've seen where people have said, no, you're not coming through my yard. And then what had to be done, even in some severe cases, roads built, because you're talking large-scale vegetation removal. Well, who's gonna restore that site after the road? And then is that road gonna contribute to problems afterwards, even if it's restored? So the plan encompasses, you know, neighborhood involvement or neighbor involvement. What is going to be the best access to get in and deal with that situation? Even dropping trees, can you drop them on your neighbor's property? Or is your neighbor gonna say, I don't want it lifted by helicopter. I don't want you to bring a crane in. I mean, some of these trees, because of the situation they're in, they're bringing cranes in to actually stabilize that tree before it's cut.
We were able to avoid that.
Okay. Yeah, see, that's the problem with slopes. And then let me step back just a second when we talk about slopes. Like, we can use these, for example. You know, everything from, you know, of course, the percent grade or degree or the percentage of slope, the aspect, whether it's north, south, east, or west, or whether it's a portion of that. The irregularities created by, you know, little hummock areas or rock outcrops. So all of those things need to be looked at, including, of course, the soil type. I'd even say, I would hope that when people do these large-scale projects like that, that they even look at harvesting plants on site first. And also, if they have an area where there's lots of good topsoil, to scrape that and put it somewhere else. Because when you take a piece of equipment in there, and you know it's going to churn and dig and churn, and yeah. And
yeah.
Yeah, and that may not be a bad thing, because in some slope stabilization, you know, a lot of biotechnology is being used these days. Like when I first started, my first big project was on a fire in South San Jose, and I was running a crew at the time, and they said, you go up and we want you to put contour trenches, hand dug contour trenches in all along those slopes. Then we want you to seed and straw it, and then we want you to put silt dams in all the drainages. And we did that for, I don't know how long it was. I had a crew of like 11 or 12 people. I mean, it was crazy what we did back then. But we've learned a lot from then. I mean, what did we use? We used ryegrass. What did we use? We used just standard straw with all kinds of weeds and stuff in it. Well, I'm gonna mention that to you. So what kind of seedless straw did you get?
Exactly.
Whatever they had down at Hearst.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, BLM, and I volunteer with them, so, you know, we've had conversations about the work that they've been doing over in Calaveras County after the Butte Fire. And, you know, one of the things that they, the Department of the Interior has very specific guidelines for the use of seed, the use of mulch, the hydro seeding, for aerial applications, aerial mulches, things like that. And so they did their best, or they thought they did. Okay, we did everything we could to get clean material. Rice straw. Most people think rice straw is the greatest thing. In fact, 20 years ago when I wasn't using rice straw, people were scolding me, you gotta use rice straw. Well, they tried to do that up there, and then all this work was done, and it's like, where'd all these invasive plants come from? And it was from the rice straw, and it was from the straw wattles. And it was from the mulch, the aerial mulch mix. And a lot of it was, my experience is, unless you go down and you actually see where all that material is harvested from and processed, you're going to get weed seeds.
Yep.
And that's just so you kind of go, okay, what seeds, what weeds are acceptable? And in your case, that's another thing you have to look at. Okay, there's a bunch of weeds. I hear this from the folks over in Calaveras County too. There's all this stuff growing on my property now, and I don't know what to do. Back to planning, okay, what do I want? What do I want to see this landscape like 10, 15, 20 years from now? What am I willing to accept? Because time, energy, and cost. and you're probably experiencing that. You could probably spend close to $500,000 on a restoration project for your property. Who's going to do that? I mean, even spending $10,000 for a lot of people, that's a lot of money. So you have to start looking at, okay, you know, how can we make all this happen? So let's say, you know, let's just use that slope where that big home is, and you've had to remove all the trees there. Hopefully, you know, a lot of the material, any organic material on the surface, any soil, good topsoil has been moved off to the side. You've harvested what plants you can. Well, then you have to look at the stability of the top 2 or 3 feet of soil. And so if you've had an excavator, or if you've had a like anything like a D6 or higher, or you've had any type of really aggressive crawling tractors on there, yeah, I mean, you're going to have to go, my gosh, look at this. And then what you have to think about is, okay, really, what do I want? I just want grasses and forbs on here because I just want to protect what's here. Because the thing is, if you want to plant shrubs and other things, you can do that later. The thing you want to do is you want to cover that slope the best you can for that first year, two, three. And my experience has been, and this is really expensive, but it works the best, is to use native straw. And there's not many places to get it from. Over in Woodland, John Anderson's place, Nike, Hedgerow Farms. I purchased Nisella pulchra, which is purple needlegrass, and Lamus trichodoides, which is creeping wild rye. I didn't use any seed at all. I just put straw mulch down from those. And now I got all these nice native grasses coming up simply from the straw. And I've been doing that I did it on my property, and I did it where I was working before. Had excellent, excellent success. Now, this is where it's interesting. A full bale, depending on when you're buying it and how often, $11 to $15, which isn't bad. Because for straw, you're going to pay anywhere from $8 to $12. And if you're buying rice straw, you may pay anywhere as far as $14 to $15. So it's like, they won't deliver, so you got to go get it. So I would, you know, get a truck and trailer and go and get it. But it works. But once again, get stuff on that slope. It's really hard to rent a straw blower. And for like an acre, that's a lot to cover. But you can do it by hand. And even prior to that, you know, if you have the soil, you've said like 2 to 3 feet, and it's like that dusty, powdery, flowery type soil, you have to get a lot of organics in there. Otherwise, it's going down the slope. And like all those, you know, the sticks and things you talked about, well, what we've done in the past is you dig little trenches and you start sticking those in there. And you don't want to put them, you don't want to put them parallel, you want to put them perpendicular to the slope. And basically, it's like artwork. So you dig these trenches, you place them in there, leave them out a little bit, because also, if you want to do some above ground natural wattles, you can use those pieces of branches sticking up to wedge up against. And, you know, some people will even use chips. And, you know, we were talking about it during the composting, the use of chips. Well, it's not the best thing to use, but let's say they ground all those trees on your property. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That must be fun.
So we're able to produce a lot of chips.
We still have another acre to clean, and so that'll work for that.
Yeah.
We produce a lot of chips. So
right.
You were saying.
So I mean, if that costs $100 versus spending, you know, $5,000 for some type of straw, then you could use that, but there's not a lot of nutrient power in those.
Right.
The rice straw has seed, it's got more nutrient power, but the wood chips will somewhat hold it. But remember, once that water dribbles through those wood chips, and especially in those flowery soils, it takes a very long time because there's nothing to hold the water together in the soil. Exactly. So once it's in there, you load up that slope, and that's when the stuff starts sliding. So Even like when you put straw in, you just don't put straw on the surface. So this is a really hard thing to do, especially when it's dry. You really need to heel it in. And basically you go through with a spade shovel or a cutter-matic or something like that, and you go through and you make sure that straw is punched into that slope. Two reasons. One, Lisa was saying, you know, it gets more organics in there, but you want something sticking up because you want it to collect anything rolling down or any needles or leaves falling off trees or anything else you want to spread on it. Right. Now, you might be able to get away with it over on this smaller slope. I don't know how steep is your slope.
It's about 14%.
Well, that's not bad then.
It's not bad, but it
okay.
continues all the way past the house.
Right. So in those early years there, you want to just get some sheet, well, I'm going to call it sheet erosion, and I shouldn't. You're going to get some sheet wash, so you want that water to fall and just kind of slowly go down the slope. So let's say that slope is much steeper. In maybe not every case, but in almost all cases, you're going to have to put some type of structure on that slope because you're not going to get it to entirely sheet at a slow pace to where you get infiltration. So the whole idea of contour trenches. Now, contour trenches come in all shapes and forms. You can dig them in, where basically, you know, if I was looking at a side, this is your slope, you dig it in and then you have a mound. So as the water's flowing down, it catches it, it retains the water in your trench so that it filtrates into the soil. Now those are okay, but you still have a lot of, you know, you still have a lot of exposed dirt or potentially exposed dirt. Let's go to straw wattles, which everybody uses, but most people install them incorrectly. It's when I started going around, you know, doing before my presentation, I'd say 7 out of 10 sites, they did the most common practice, which is to throw the straw wattle on the ground and put a few stakes in. And what happens? The water travels down. There's no real good soil contact, or it's not below and it just goes right underneath it. There's so many of those examples where you see the straw wattle all faded down. Installation issue. It's not that the product is good if it's installed properly. You have to bury that material. Situations like yours, it's going to be hard to get a trencher up there, or even you don't want to run any more equipment. So, but you want to bury those things about a third of that straw. Well, it depends on the slope and the distance, but about a third of that straw wattle should be under the ground. And then it should be staked. And Caltrans has some really good specifications. They not only stake, but they wrap with rope. So it's a really nice, tight, you know, surface barrier. The other thing is to, and this is what is nice when you have a whole bunch of trees down and you're looking for something that's virtually free, is to just do a bioengineered swale, which is basically similar to what I was saying with your sticks, but you put a few more sticks and you either weave material in between the sticks or you just lay it up against it, depending on what you have. So let's say you have a whole bunch of ponderosa pine limbs and gnarly material. You still have to be below the surface because you don't want that water going underneath, but you can weave it, and then what you can do is you can get pine needles or you can get, you know, and even compacted needles, that works best. You know, when they've sat there for a while, so it's almost like a clump. And you can chink in between those logs. Or you can get, you know, other types of vegetation maybe on the property. Those work really well. The other thing is, if you want to seed, you can seed behind them. You know, and so you get all this nice seed, and then it creates that additional barrier. Because depending on the soils, where I was working in the Santa Cruz Mountains, we had highly erodible soils. And so we had to build a structure to be bomb-proof for 10 years. And if we didn't do that, we had erosion problems, especially when we were taking old logging roads out of use and restoring the slope. I mean, that type of work is incredibly expensive. So the first year, really what you want is just something to, you know, get some roots down, hold the soil. We all think of, you know, water as the erosive force, but it's actually water and soil. Because, you know, if the water comes down, it grabs on. If the soil is exposed, it grabs onto that little bit of soil. And that's what starts, you know, moving around. That's what actually starts to erode the surface or whatever it is. Once you've done that, You have to look at, go out in the storm, go out after a storm. Okay, where are we having problems? And it sounds like maybe what is happening in your case is the water's coming down and there's a side, there's a lateral channel coming off. Then you have to decide, okay, do we put that lateral channel into another contour trench? You know, you'll see a lot of these where the contour trench is here, the idea being water runs here. When it gets here, there's another contour trench. So it's basically like a zigzag coming down the slope. I'm not real fond of those because what I want to do is capture any soil and keep it right at that trench. In your case, if it's starting to erode on the edges, then you have to look at what they call armoring. So if you can't go out because your neighbor's property's there, or you're going to be precluded because of other vegetation, then you just start, you have to look at, okay, do we have logs and rocks around, and start burying those near that point. Now, you could go to the effort of getting filter fabric and landscape fabric and putting it underneath and putting that down. But honestly, if you just try and dissipate the energy, that water being moved, you'll be fine. And then try to get any type of woody material in there, and that'll start to slow that down. Going back a little bit to what I was talking about earlier, I lived in the Santa Cruz Mountains. I worked up there for 24 years. I worked for a park agency. My crews were out whenever it was raining. Their shift, their 8-hour, 10-hour, 12-hour shift was out in the park or out wherever they needed to be. And they're walking trails, walking roads, dealing with plugged culverts, trees, whatever the case may be. When we did that, we never had a problem. Well, because of monetary issues and staffing, you really can't do that anymore. But how do you know what the problem is? There were times when I could go out and then I could have somebody come and say, oh, this is a problem, this is what you need to do. And I'm like, no, that never happened. I was there when it happened. This is what the problem is. Oh, well, we didn't realize that because they didn't get the full exposure of, you know, that time when they were seeing it. And that's why it's important for all of these. People think the erosion structure's in place, don't have to worry about it. Well, you can't. Especially the first year, every storm you should be out there. And then it's a matter of, it's the whole idea, you know, like our lives are, you know, like you do something and you need to monitor it, see if it works. I mean, I hate to say it, but even our relationships are that way. You know, you get married and then you go, oh, everything's wonderful. And then you find out my wife doesn't like this. My husband doesn't like this. Oh, we need to be monitoring that stuff. I know that's kind of maybe well, but it is kind of that way. You can't, you got to get out. Absolutely. And then you're going to go, oh, why? We should have done that. Easy fix. Once the storm passes, you go out and work on it. And then during that whole time, what you're doing is you're sitting down in the home and you're going, okay, what do we want that slope to look like in 2, 3, 4 out? And that's when you start putting together, okay, we know the soils, we know this. Ooh, let's bring some rocks in. Or, you know, we've always wanted to do this. Okay, well, to get a tree to that stage, you know, okay, what's the cost going to be? All of those things. And that can happen after, you know, 2, 3, 4, even 5 years. But the most important thing sounds like what you folks did, is you want to stabilize, you want to keep that soil there, and putting grasses and forbs in is the best thing you can do. The type of mixes you use, that's where it is a lot of personal choice, but really have to watch what you buy, because you'll see erosion control mixes all over the world. And I don't mean just internationally and all that. I mean, you could have a mix that says, oh, these are all native grasses and forbs. Well, where are they native to? And I can't tell you, in my early days when we were told to go out and seed areas, you know, we'd go, okay, well, there's a Santa Cruz Mountain erosion control mix. We go out there and we're spraying the seed. You go out there next, you go, what the hell's that? You know, wind poppies? We don't have those here. Yeah, right. But see, we don't check. Now what they do is, most of those packets, they list everything that's in there.
This show was taped at the Demonstration Garden located at 251 South Beretta Street here in downtown Sonora, and this show has been brought to you by the UCCE, Master Gardeners of Tuolumne County.